This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Good evening, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here, when the people speak, we make a difference. It's a pleasure tonight to have with me a very brave woman in light of all that we witness going on. Marianne Wright has had an incredible career as a military woman, a State Department diplomat, and in the last few years, she has become a spokesperson for the anti-war movement. Hello, Anne. Welcome to the People Speak Radio. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
You have an incredible history and career. And can you tell us a little bit about where you came from and how your career evolved from a military person to an anti-war person?
Surely. Yes, I grew up in the state of Arkansas. I joined the Army right after college for many of the same reasons that a lot of people join the military. In my case, it was to travel. I wanted to get out of Arkansas. I wanted to go see the world. And at that time, which was back in the middle 60s, the career opportunities for women centered around being a teacher, a nurse, a homemaker, a secretary, all very honorable professions, but none of which I wanted to do. And when the Army came through town saying, join the Army, see the world, you won't have to go to Vietnam, because this was during the Vietnam War, because you're a woman, unless you volunteer or unless you're a nurse, I thought, well, I can put up with that if that can get me the GI Bill and also to travel to other places, but not Vietnam. And so I ended up joining up for 2 years, and then it became 3 years, and then it became 29 years. And that included 13 on active duty and 16 in the reserves. I retired as a colonel in 1996 from the Army Reserves. And then about halfway through that in the middle 1980s, I looked at other career possibilities, and they centered on the Foreign Service, the diplomatic corps. So in 1987, I joined the U.S. Diplomatic Corps and was in that for 16 years until March of 2003, when I resigned in opposition to the war in Iraq.
Now, why in opposition to the war in Iraq specifically?
Well, it's a good question, because of all the time that I was in either the military or the State Department, which started in like 1967, there were plenty of very controversial programs and policies that the eight different presidential administrations that I worked under had created. And there were people in our government that did resign over some of those policies. And for me, when I found ways that I didn't agree with a lot of the policies of all these administrations, but I decided I wanted to have a career in the government, and I held my nose to a lot of policies that others resigned over. But it was that decision to invade and occupy an oil-rich Arab Muslim country that had not attacked the United States, and that had nothing to do with 9/11, and that had been under a 10-year quarantine and two no-fly zones after Gulf War I. It just didn't make a bit of sense to me that the United States, even though the allegations of weapons of mass destruction, but it didn't ring solid to me that first they existed, and secondly because we had years of UN weapons inspectors who had been in Iraq, most of whom were U.S. intelligence agents that were seconded to the UN to be on those inspection teams. So I, at long last, ended up resigning from the State Department in opposition to the war in Iraq. I also, in my letter of resignation, though, listed some other things that I was very concerned about, And one of them was the issue of the unbalanced policies of all U.S. administrations on the issue of Israel and Palestine.
And may I ask you, Anne, did you come to this determination that there was unfair policies in this area of our foreign policy? By what? What were the conclusions that helped you to understand that this was unfair? What was going on?
Well,
there?
Being in. Being an American citizen, having seen what the U.S. government was doing over decades, and as a U.S. Diplomat, one of the very first questions that I got asked every country that I was assigned to with the U.S. embassies, and there were eight of those, one of the very first questions was, what is it about the United States that they always support Israel no matter what is going on? And never, ever, acknowledge that there are grievances that the Palestinians have. And I agreed with that, although I hadn't resigned over it. But I certainly did agree with it that the policies of the United States were very, very unbalanced. And so I put that in my letter of resignation.
Now, according to the way it works in the military, if you are the only way that you can dissent on an issue and not follow a direct order would be to actually resign from your position, and that's why you did it, correct?
Well, yes. Although I resigned from the diplomatic corps, I'd already retired from the military, so I resigned from the U.S. State Department, and. Before I resigned, I did, within the U.S. government circles and the State Department, I used what's called the dissent channel, and I raised the issues of Iraq primarily in this cable that went from me, and I was at the time assigned to the U.S. Embassy in Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia. I sent my concerns about what the Bush administration was about to do in Iraq. And sent them directly to Colin Powell in a dissent cable. And I did that about 3 weeks before I ultimately resigned. So I did raise the issues before I resigned. And you're right, to come out publicly against policies while you're still in the government well, you can do it, but that'll probably be your last day in your
position. Either resign or get fired. I guess resignation would
well,
be
that's
at
right.
least in your hands.
You would be pretty well fired if you came out in public opposition to these policies. And then not to say that there aren't thousands, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of U.S. government employees who disagree with major policies of whatever administration's in power. But you can see that resignation is not one of the time-honored traditions of our government service. There were only three of us in the entire federal government who resigned in opposition to the war in Iraq, and yet there were hundreds of people that emailed me, primarily from the U.S. Diplomatic Corps, but some from other agencies, saying, you're doing exactly the right thing, and I wish I could resign, but I've got kids in college, I've got mortgages, I've got all these other things, and I don't know what I would do, what I would do to support myself if I resigned. They emailed these thoughts after I resigned, and the other two people who resigned also received similar emails from all over the world from U.S. government employees saying that we were doing the right thing, but for whatever reason it was, they themselves couldn't see their way clear to resign.
May I ask you, Anne, how did you feel about those letters of support, but at the same time the apathetic nature of the position they were dealing with?
Well, on one level, there were other. I don't really want to criticize other people on when they take action on their, you know, on issues of principle or conscience, because you know, we all come to it at a different point and for different reasons. There were people that had resigned over the Vietnam War, and yet that's when I joined the government. There were people who almost resigned. There were three people that resigned over the lack of the United States doing anything to stop the genocide that was going on in the Balkans. And yet I did not write a letter of protest. I wasn't assigned in that region of the world. That's no excuse, though. But there were other times when others took action and I did not. So just because I took my action at this stage, I don't try to judge other people on what they did and did not do, although I would certainly say that of all of the policies of the last at least two decades, this war in Iraq has to be one of the biggest blunders and horrific things that the U.S. government has done, and that's the top of a long pile of things that the U.S. has done that hasn't been too good.
Let me ask you something, Anne. Considering your history and the intrinsic knowledge of both the military and the diplomatic relations with different areas of the Middle East, was it really a blunder? Isn't it true that some of the American corporations have made more profit in the last 10 years in Iraq than companies like Bechtel, Halliburton, GE have seen in the history of the company? Could that be considered a mistake or a blunder? Aren't our interests being aren't the interests of these companies exploiting the situation?
Well, you're exactly right, and I would say that my terminology for the blunder is the overall policy towards, you know, that the rest of the world sees as a U.S. government horrible, horrible decision to go to war. Indeed, it has been a financial mega treasure for U.S. corporations. It is unbelievable, the graft of corruption. The sole source bidding, the multi-billion-dollar contracts that companies like Halliburton, that of course was our former vice president Cheney was the former CEO of Halliburton, coming from that to go into the vice presidency. I mean, it is just totally outrageous and sickening, the amount of wasted money, purposely wasted, getting to the corporations of our country. To do this war, and I think you're exactly right that they're a part of the calculation of the Bush administration was certainly to build up corporate support for the Bush administration on other areas, and buying them off through war is one of the almost a time-honored tradition now in the United States.
Now, one of the other things that my major concern, and this is something that I think the fear for me is at the tip of my list of things to be concerned about. In the event we attacked Iraq, during this attack, we know very well that we have also destroyed many very strategic areas that are between the Iraq-Iran border. And we didn't do this by accident. Isn't the golden egg really the ultimate attack on Iran? And that everything that we're doing in the Iraqi region is just preparation, softening the enemy, preparing the ground for the ground war, preparing for all of these things that are inevitable if we do that?
Well, certainly the Iranian revolution has been in the crosshairs of U.S. foreign policy, the target of U.S. foreign policy for decades, ever since the Shah was overthrown and U.S. corporations thrown out of Iran. The Bush administration, which made lots and lots of preparations, one could say, was stifled at the end, I think, because of a lot of citizen protest. I can remember going to the White House with boxes. I think the boxes had pages that had over 40,000 signatures from Americans saying, don't bomb Iran. And going into the Congress right after Senator John McCain had made that, you know, his big joke about bomb Iran. Mm-hmm. Well, we were in there going into his office, taking over his office for an hour, saying, you know, this is outrageously wrong what he's trying to, I mean, the lightness of which he was making this. We took the 40,000 signatures to the front gate of the White House. Of course, the guards at the front gate say we can't accept any boxes, any letters. We can't accept anything. You have to mail them. And we, of course, knew that they would never see the light of day if we did that. So if I remember right, it was Ray McGovern, I think maybe Cindy Sheehan, Medea Benjamin, David Swanson, and a whole raft of other great activists who... We each took a box of those things and stood up on the little ledge right next to the fence and just started throwing these papers over the fence. Well, of course, the cops went berserk. You know, you can't do that. Stop doing that. Stop doing this. And in the meantime, there were these signatures of Americans just flying all over the lawn of the White House. Not to say that itself... stop the Bush administration, but it does indicate that there was a lot of pushback throughout the country on that, and there still is today as the Obama administration really is just the continuation of the Bush administration with the same war policies, the same timetable supposedly of withdrawal from Iraq, but the indications are that we will be having military forces that will be staying behind after the last year of 50,000. I'm sure there will be tens of thousands of American troops that will be in Iraq for a long period of time, plus all of those military contractors, which will number at least double what our military is. We'll have civilian contractors there, many of whom are part of the security groups that the military hires to protect the military. Now, isn't that ironic? Here we say we've got the strongest, bravest, most courageous military in the world, and we have to have civilian contractors protect them. Of course, that's another part of this privatization of military functions to throw government functions into the private sector. And many of those people, I mean, essentially you can call these security groups mercenary groups who do certainly have the lay of the land between and in that the area along the Iranian border.
Now, and I do call them mercenaries. We can call them whatever we want.
Yeah, they are mercenaries.
They're paid snipers is what they are. And I mean snipers. And that's interesting. Anne, let me ask you, you were deeply entrenched in organizing Camp Casey with Cindy Sheehan, among other things. Can you tell us briefly about that?
Yeah, well, and I just saw on the internet today that Cindy has posted on her Facebook that the IRS is coming after her for non-payment of taxes, which all began back in 2004 with the death of her son, who was in the U.S. Army and was killed in Iraq. And Cindy, who began really speaking out strongly against the war in late 2004 and then 2005, and then who at the Veterans for Peace Conference in Dallas, Texas in early August of 2005 said that she was going to go to Crawford, Texas, which was about 2 hours south of Dallas, and she was going to walk right up to President Bush's ranch and and give him a piece of her mind and say what noble question, what noble causes, as Bush had characterized the Iraq War. She was going to challenge him, and so she said to the Veterans for Peace convention, come with me. Now, I was there with the Veterans for Peace and speaking also at that conference, and so off we went, and we probably took three-quarters of the convention with us and challenged Bush out, and then I can remember vividly that hot, hot August day. It must have been 185 degrees. The pavement, the asphalt was melting as we walked along this this little country road, and the police wouldn't let us get anywhere near Bush's ranch, and we ended up just saying, well, we're going to sit here until someone comes out to talk to Cindy, and sitting over in the rattlesnake-infested ditches, and at the end of this long, hot day, Cindy saying, you know, I'm going to stay. I'm just going to stay until he talks to me. And we all kind of looked at each other like, what do you mean you're going to
stay? What does that mean?
She said, I'm just going to stay. I'm just going to sit here until he comes to talk. Well, at the end of the day, there were six people that stayed that night with her. The rest of us had to go back to Dallas because it was the final banquet of the Veterans for Peace. But the next morning, here started another convoy down to Crawford, and we stayed there for 27 days in the ditches of Crawford, Texas. And during that time, and that was 6 years ago, during that time, over 15,000 people made the trek into this little bitty town of Crawford, Texas, to join with Cindy and other Gold Star parents whose or family members whose loved ones had been killed in the Iraq War. And it was an unbelievable time. And we were certainly hoping that that time of tremendous media attention to Camp Casey, Cindy, and the other Gold Star families would be the turning point in the war. And the following year, it was there was a lot of action. That was movement, a lot of people's movement on trying to get that war ended. But despite all of that pressure from the people, the Bush administration ignored the people and continued the war. And we're still here. Now it is at the eighth year of the war in Iraq and the end of the 10th year in the war in Afghanistan, and a new
I thought somebody told me recently that the war that we're not at war in Iraq anymore. I said, really?
Well,
maybe you should talk to all the dead bodies that are coming back from there and tell them that they're not really dead either.
Well, that's right, and the Iraqi people.
It's amazing. You know, there's so much here that we need to discuss, but before we do, I would appreciate if you gave Cindy my best next time you speak with her. Tell her that Basma from the People Speak Radio sends her deepest regards.
I surely will. Thank you.
And, you know, I'd like to get to the issue of the flotillas. The Audacity of Hope was one of the boats that you were on, if I'm not mistaken, Anne?
Yes, that's right. I was an organizer for the Audacity of Hope, the U.S. boat to Gaza, which was a part of a 10-boat flotilla that attempted to go to Gaza in July of this year. I had been on the previous flotilla in 2010, that had been shot up by the Israeli commandos. There were six boats that were a part of that, including a very large ship called the Mavi Marmara that was sponsored by a Turkish non-governmental agency, a humanitarian organization. And nine people were murdered on that boat by the Israeli commandos, eight Turkish citizens and one American citizen. And then over 50 were wounded, many of them severely, and in fact one more of one of the people that had been wounded and who had essentially been in a coma for this last year has passed. So really, now we should up that number, that there were 10 people that were killed by the Israelis on that terrible response to international citizen activist challenging the naval blockade of Gaza. The naval blockade, which in combination with the land blockade, has essentially made Gaza this tiny little strip of land, 25 miles long and 5 miles wide, 1.6 million people living there, in essentially an open-air prison.
Now, as a Palestinian myself, I've never been to Gaza because of various reasons and constraints whenever I have gone back there, and plus the fact that I have a lot of family there, and it was we were very busy. But can you tell us, I know that you have been to Gaza, can you describe some of the conditions that the Gazians are going through right as we speak?
Surely. I made three trips to Gaza in 2009 following the Israeli attack on Gaza, the 22-day attack that killed 1,440 people, wounded 5,000, and left over 50,000 homeless. I was there right at the end of the Israeli attack and saw the fresh bombings of Gaza. I went back two other times with the Code Pink Women for Peace, who organized groups of people, 60 at a time, to go back into Gaza. And subsequently, and later on in 2009 and in 2010, they've organized three more trips for people to go in to see with their own eyes the level of destruction, the disproportionate use of force that the Israelis have used on Gaza, the war crimes that have been committed on Gaza, the level of destruction of government facilities, of businesses, of homes, was just horrific. I myself have been in the military. I've seen military operations before, and I've seen the results of U.S. military operations, and attacks are horrible, and the Israelis had a level of violence against the Palestinians that I don't think I'd ever seen personally before. Using U.S. government aircraft, F-16s, Apache helicopters that the U.S. has given, and their $3 billion a year that the United States gives in military aid to Gaza or to Israel, the white phosphorus bombs made in the United States, the dense inert metal explosive bombs, new types of bombs that were used kind of experimentally, I would say, for the first time. And the victims of the experiment were the people of Gaza, who were sliced apart by these bombs that send out a sheen of atomized tungsten that slices through arms and legs and amputates people. It was horrific to see the results of that horrible 22-day attack on Gaza. And since then, here we are 2.5 years later, and the level of reconstruction is pitiful.
It's pathetic, that I absolutely know.
Mm-hmm. It's just, it is astounding the electrical grid that is just broken, the sewage that still over 80 million liters of raw sewage goes into the Mediterranean every single day from Gaza because the sewage plant was bombed and it's not been able to be repaired because the Israelis won't let the repair equipment.
Now, may I ask you something, Ann? Because when I read your bio, one of the things that I read in it, if I'm not mistaken, that during the time that you were with the military, that part of your job was to protect these very entities, sewage plants, libraries, electrical grids, water supplies, to protect these facilities. Why isn't anybody protecting these, from the American military, protecting these in Gaza?
Well, the law of land warfare says that attacking forces cannot target those types of civil infrastructure. That you cannot just totally destroy a country And that's exactly what the Israelis have done. And, of course, the United States being a co-partner with the Israelis, that the United States is protects Israel by in UN votes. It protects Israel from criticism throughout the world. In fact, that's now the stated policy of the Obama administration, to prevent criticism of Israel, much less... I mean, there's no way in the world that the United States, under any of these administrations, is going to come to the aid of Gaza because of the huge Israeli lobby that there is that buys off our congressmen and women and the administration. And it is a pitiful, horrible statement about the situation of our own political system, where we are really so disingenuous, saying that we're a real democracy. We aren't. We are a country with a government that's bought by corporate interests and by other national interests, and primarily the state of Israel.
The myth here is that Israel's the only democracy in the Middle East, which is a complete distortion of truth. Democracies don't threaten by great majorities of people in the Knesset to obliterate the Arabic language in Israel. And that's one of the laws that they're trying to pass now in the Knesset. Over, I think it's 20 out of 28 MKs from the Knesset are voting to have Arabic removed from the language. So these distortions of truth are interesting, to say the least. Let me ask you, Greece, are they kidding me here?
Well,
What is it that Israel offers these people that they would turn against such humanitarian like yourself and the flotillas? What is it that Israel has given the Grecian governments?
Certainly it's the leverage. They buy off countries. And Greece, which is a country in extraordinarily deep economic distress, tragically has allowed itself to be bought off by Israel. The Israeli government had special trade agreements that started. Well, this all started a year ago when the Turkish government, of course, was furious and is still extraordinarily angry with Israel for the Israeli attack on the Turkish ship that killed 8 Turks and an American and wounded 50 Turkish citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Israel and Turkey had been, I guess, reasonably good friends.
Yes, they were considered this side of right.
Yeah, well, and Israel had sold a lot of military equipment to Turkey, including drones that are used on Kurds in Turkey. They had a military-to-military relationship that suddenly took a nosedive because of the Israeli attack on the Mar of Marmara. Well, shortly after that, Israel had to start searching out for other allies in the region, and seeing Greece starting to go down the tubes economically, they immediately made a trade deal with Greece. Netanyahu made a special trip to Greece in August of 2010 and spent 2 days there in the company of the Prime Minister of Greece. So they very quickly shifted, knowing that they needed another ally in the region. They needed to buy someone off, and this economic crisis was one place they felt that they could twist the Greeks on potential Israeli tourism into Greece, and so they started currying favor with the Greek government. And the Greeks, of all people, they were the ones that were my understanding is they were the first country to recognize the PLO and the first country to give the PLO an office space was in Greece. And so here you have 40 years later, you have a Greek government that turns on the plight of the Palestinians by allowing the Israelis to convince them that they should stop all the ships that were a part of the flotilla that were in Greece, not allow them to take off from Greek waters to go toward Gaza.
And what is the status of the flotillas as we speak today?
Well, it was a very interesting time in Greece. I spent about 6 weeks there prior to.
Yeah, they have had. They've certainly had their share of events lately.
Oh, they have. I mean, we were there during the time when there were general strikes, with massive protests, hundreds of thousands of Greeks taking to the streets of Athens, and major riots going on with tear gas like I have never, ever seen in my whole life through the capital city of Athens. Well, that was all going on as the Greek government had issued an order that the eight boats of the Gaza flotilla who were in Greek waters could not sail from Greece to Gaza. It was forbidden, and our ships were essentially locked down at docks. The U.S. ship, we decided that we were going to try to break out of this because we felt it was an illegal order, that you just can't order ships not to go on a political mission. We had invited them to inspect our ship, make sure there were no weapons, nothing like that. In fact, we had all sorts of media that were on board the ship, but we gave them full access to everything. We had the New York Times, we had, we had Democracy Now, yay. And then we had the New York Times, we had CBS, we had a variety of media on our boat. And on the 2nd of July, we left our dock against orders from the Greek government and made it about 3 miles out into the outside of the port of Piraeus, the port for Athens, before a Greek Coast Guard vessel came racing out to stop us by putting their ship in front of ours. And as we had a standoff there for about 30 minutes before another boat arrived, which was filled with Greek commandos. They looked like Ninja Turtles. They had all of them. They were decked out like the Israelis would be decked out. And at the end of this about a 2.5-hour standoff, we went back into a military port where our boat was impounded, and in fact is still there. There were two of the boats. Well, one of the eight boats has been able to leave Greece. The rest of them are in Greek ports. We did have one boat that left Corsica, France, and actually did make it to about 60 miles off Gaza before the Israelis stopped it. And we had a boat that was in Turkey that was sabotaged by, we were quite certain, by Mossad. They cut the propeller, the axle that goes to the propeller. They sliced that, as they did the same exact thing to one of the boats that was in the dry dock in Athens. So we had sabotage that was going on. It was a dangerous situation. I mean, Mossad is a dangerous group, the Israeli intelligence group. They assassinate people. They sabotage vessels. I mean, those two acts were acts of terrorism. But, of course, we can't get the American government to acknowledge that, or the Greek government. But, indeed, the Israelis were committing acts of terrorism again this year.
And I don't. Do you foresee them stopping that? If I'm not mistaken, one of the things that I've heard recently is that Israel is planning on arming some trained settlers in the region. So if they're planning on arming the settlers, which they already do, just for everybody's information, I find that to be non-conducive to the peace process or any kind of peace.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the settlers are heavily, heavily armed, and in fact, the settlers are really beholden to no one. I mean, they are a force of their own that even the Netanyahu government doesn't mess with them. They occupy illegally Palestinian lands. They take over Palestinian homes. They are there with their weapons. They kill Palestinians. They beat up Palestinians. And that's kind of the that's the extra governmental stuff that's going on there, while the Israeli government itself is creating the apartheid walls that separate Palestinian families from their schools and their workplaces and their farms, and horrific checkpoints that are the most degrading types of control of people and putting hundreds, thousands of Palestinians every day through the most degrading and horrific affronts to their humanity by what these young Israeli soldiers do to the Palestinians that are just trying to get to school or to work.
And unfortunately, the peace activists... The peace activists from the Israeli side are also under fire, from Israel. I mean, they're not particular. Anybody that sides with Israel is at risk. It doesn't matter if you're an American. It doesn't matter if you're an Israeli. It doesn't matter if you're a Palestinian. It doesn't matter. You know, you are at risk if you side with the Palestinian people.
Well, that's right. There are a lot of Jewish people, Israeli citizens, and who are totally opposed to what the Israeli government is doing. And the ones that live in Israel that try to be a voice of reason and of a justice for everyone are really very brave people to stand up to. Or attempt to stand up to their own government, which really just is unmerciful to them as well as to the Palestinians. It's really quite an unbelievable situation. The force that's used against people, and yet there still are groups of Israeli citizens that are willing to stand up, and to include people in the military. The group called Combatants for Peace, men and women who have been in the Israeli military and who have refused orders to go to the occupied territories or to fly missions over them, and who have been put in jail for these refusals. And in fact, one of the persons who is one of the most eloquent spokespersons for the Combatants for Peace is a man named Yonatan Shapira. And we invited him to be on our U.S. boat to Gaza because he is such a symbol of Israeli citizen resistance to these horrific policies of the Israeli government. So he was with us, and he actually was on another boat that attempted to go into Gaza back in the autumn of last year. It was called the Jewish-German boat. It was a small catamaran that only had about 12 people on it. And he and his brother, who also is a combatant for peace from Israel, were both on that boat. They were both treated brutally by the Israeli military and commandos, who pulled them immediately off the boat, put them on the Israeli boat, and tasered both of them. Yonatan tells the story of how they ripped off his life jacket, pulled back his shirt, and tasered him right in his chest, attempting to kill him.
You know, we have a little bit of time, and what I'd like to ask of you, Anne, is as an activist, as someone that's been on both sides of the fence, so to speak, or the wall in this case, what are your suggestions for people to help to support Palestine and its position Do you have advice to give to the average citizen? Where do we turn to if we choose to help? Those kinds of questions. I think they're very important. I think that originally when we started this program, our inspiration was to help inspire people to become active and to let people know that it really wasn't as difficult as many people seem to think it is to be active in your societies. How can you help people to see that they can help the people of Palestine?
Well, surely, and it's not that you have to be a passenger on a boat confronting face-to-face the Israeli military. I mean, that's kind of on one level, on the extreme end of this. The day-to-day work of challenging in our own communities, challenging Israel and its apartheid policies, there are things that you can do there, joining the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Program, the BDS program, going to your grocery stores and seeing what is products from Israel that can be identified that are actually products of the occupied territories that are being used, resources being used by Israel in contravention to international law that says an occupier cannot use the resources of the occupied. There's a very strong BDS movement in the United States now, and joining up with the people that are with that, and some very energizing activities of doing flash mobs that all of a sudden, you know, 100 people show up at a place to sing and dance, and in contrast to some of the flash mobs that apparently go in and ransack a store. That's not what these flash mobs do. They highlight what it is that's going badly in that store. That's a very important one to let, because many times the storekeepers don't even know what types of products they have, and that they will voluntarily take these things off their shelves. And another one is supporting groups that are putting very public posters out. Right now in Portland, Oregon, and in, I believe it's Oakland, there are posters that are approved to be put on the buses and public transportation that say, why does the U.S. must end its military aid to Israel? Mm-hmm. And those are very important things to help educate people. I mean, why are we spending $3 billion on Israel's military? Keeping oneself informed about what's really going on in Gaza, what's going on with in the UN in September with the discussion about what is the future of the Palestinian people, what type of how is there international pressure that can be put for the Palestinians, and what type of government do they want? There's so many different things that are happening, and just getting involved with the local groups, because in virtually every town around, there's a Palestinian support group. So there's a lot we can do, and the more we get out of our own comfort zone, the better off we are. We learn a lot by making that effort.
Well, for those that don't know, In Washington, D.C., the House and Congress passed last month in July, much to my chagrin, said that if, in fact, Palestine attempted to seek sovereignty through the United Nations on September 15th, that the United States has already approved that sanctions be placed on the Palestinian country, government, and people. While in Washington, we tried to lobby against that. Unfortunately, we didn't stand a chance in hell. But I think those are some of the things that a lot of people have to understand. You know, it isn't that we may never be able to change some of these things, but we can't sit back and allow it to happen without at least trying. I think this is one of the greatest things that we have to deal with. We have a question from one of our audience members for you. Mike in California asks, how does Anne feel about Obama threatening the United Nations over recognition of Palestine?
Well, I think it's outrageous. I think the Obama administration is no different at all from any of these other administrations that the Obama personally has decided that the support of AIPAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, and its huge money and lobbying, he wants their support, and so he's willing to throw the Palestinian issue under the bus for it, even though he will say, well, you know, we're trying to help broker a peace, we're help trying to do that. Well, it's a one-sided thing. He's not helping at all, in my opinion, and it's no different from any of these other administrations.
No, what I have to tell you is that they are doing something. They are brokering a peace process, and the peace process is the continuation of the status quo, because all we are is always in process. The peace negotiation is a non-existent entity, and if you'll listen to the dialogue, if you listen to how they speak and how they refer to it, it is the we need to get back into the peace process. We need to talk about the peace process. Process to Palestinians is more of the same. More killing, more brutality, more starvation, more languishing days in the sun with no jobs, no education, no ability to move freely. That's what peace process means to Palestinians. So we do have another question from Dave in Canada, and he asked, do you see a presidential candidate that might be helpful to your cause?
Well, no, I don't.
I was going to say, boy, I hope she has somebody, because I sure don't.
Yeah, there's nobody. I mean, when you have 81 of your Congress, one-fifth of the U.S. Congress will be in Israel this month, paid for by an AIPAC educational committee. We have none of the presidential candidates on the Republicans, for God's sakes, much less you know, the Democrats, none of them are standing up at all for the Palestinians. Dennis Kucinich, if he would run, that would be one thing. Ralph Nader, that would be another one. But none of the mainstream candidates at all are willing to buck the enormous political lobbying power that AIPAC has been allowed to wield. I mean, it is outrageous that our political system is being held hostage by people who support the policies of another country that are so detrimental, really, to the national security interests of the United States.
I know myself. Someone said that when I suggested that there really wasn't a candidate that was able to change the direction and the course that our government is going in. Although I do believe in that the people have all complete control, unfortunately, I also believe in the reality that many of our citizens have given away their positions. They're comfortable, and it doesn't hurt them enough for them to get involved with their communities and their governments. So under those circumstances, do I sound helpless? Absolutely no. Am I hopeless? Absolutely not. What do I do? And these are the things that Anne was talking about a few minutes ago. There's so much that we have the availability of doing. You can sign petitions. You can attend protests and marches. You can write to your Congress. You can lobby your Congress, your Senate. You know, one of the questions that I asked Anne, and I found that to be very interesting, I said, who in this area knows where their representatives meet on a monthly or bimonthly basis? And they do meet. They do meet with their constituents. And not one person was able to answer that. And that's very, very sad. But anyway, this has been a fascinating discussion. I appreciate you. I appreciate you. I appreciate you. As a Palestinian American, it is people like you that have kept our faith in humanity alive for 63 years, fighting this brutal and insane occupation at the hands of a nation of people that should absolutely never have even begun to engage in this kind of enterprise. Shame on Israel. Shame on Israel. And congratulations. I look forward to hearing what's going to be happening with the flotilla. And good luck to you. And if there's any way that we can help, we would be more than happy to.
Well, thank you so much. And I echo what you've said, that it's up to us. It's our responsibilities as world citizens. When we see injustices, we must speak out and take action against them. And certainly the injustices dealt to the Palestinians over these last 63 years have been horrific, and it's time that end. And it will only end when the people of the world are so outraged that they force their governments to do what's right and to protect the interests of the Palestinians treat people with respect and dignity and allow them to have their own country.
Well, thank you.
So much.
It's a pleasure. Anne Wright, thank you very much. Next week's guest will be, let me see, who is next week's guest? Mike, you're slacking. Well, there's going to be a guest, that's for sure. I look forward to seeing you all next week. Have a wonderful weekend, holiday weekend. Be safe and be active. After all, when the people speak, we make a difference. Thank you, and let the people speak.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office I saw my people, and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.